So here we go. And I'm really excited for this week. So I'm not going to keep talking other than to say thank you so much for being here. And it was interesting when I woke up this morning, Sarah pointed out to me that in the New York Times, there's an article about how people are using genetic information to justify the death of Black people in police custody. Kind of an interesting application. So, take it away.
Well, thank you. We will, let's see. Would you let me share my screen, please?
You are set. Yes, you can share your screen.
There I can. And there's my presentation. And I am pleased to be here to talk about one of my most long-term concerns with the field that I've been working in as an ethicist, that we focus so much in genomic medicine on genetics and generating information that has substantial potential to be valuable and useful in hu people's lives, human lives, crops, and so on, that we don't focus enough, particularly with regard to health applications, on what we would need to do with the information, how we can actually employ it, what the behaviors are that are necessary to make good use of that information. So the themes that we've discussed thus far sort of begin to touch on or prepare us for that concern that I want to discuss today, because I've suggested that it's very important for any type of testing to know why you're doing the test. And that's true in genetics and medicine, medical testing of any kind. It's also true in education, as we've seen this year, where the SAT and the ACT could not be given to our high school juniors and seniors. And so we did away with them. And now many of us are wondering, well, why did we ever need that particular test at all? I receive an ad for, test my front yard for this or that. And if I have a good reason, I go ahead and pay the money. But the advertisement alone of saying that the test is available isn't enough to persuade me that I want to spend that money or create that concern for me and my family. So, in short, we need to consider whether and when knowledge is actually empowering and recognize that even accurate information can have negative effects on people and social institutions. So we need to figure out what we're going to do with the information we create. Not stick our heads in the sand, but really anticipate what we're going to do. And then a second area of themes has been that precision medicine is merely a tool, not a complete medical revolution. It's just a highly refined, but still population-based, evidence-based medical approach. It's a refinement of what we've been doing for centuries. And that genetics is a tool in the human body to build the body itself. Out of proteins, we get livers and kidneys and brains. And it's as a field of inquiry, it's a discovery tool. And in both cases, the genetics themselves must mix, the genes or the genetics must mix with environments, uterine, physical, social environments, other fields of knowledge to produce something useful. And next time, we're going to move beyond today's discussion, and with all those themes in mind, to talk about whether there really is such a thing as nature versus nurture, or whether it's really and nurture, which I think it is. And I'll be suggesting next time that with knowledge, even that which we consider to be natural, like our genes, really becomes very much social, at least socially mediated. We've talked about different types or uses of genetic testing, and today we're going to talk about predictive testing for susceptibility to disease, particularly for breast cancer, the BRCA1 and 2 BRCA mutations, and talk also about polygenic risk scores, which are scores, a level of risk score based on multiple genes in the body, each of which may have a small effect in leading to conditions like heart disease, diabetes. And we'll talk very briefly about tumor testing to guide treatment. So those of you who were here, and I think it was most of you, remember Mr. Gordon, my hypothetical 55-year-old African-American patient who went to see his doctor because he was increasingly depressed because of the death of his sister, who had died about a year and a half earlier of cancer, we'll say breast cancer. And he had sought out direct-to-consumer genetic testing, hoping to find some more family connections, but also obtaining a variety of health-relevant information, including what we'll talk about today, an increased risk for type 2 diabetes. So not the juvenile, not the early childhood adolescent onset, but adult onset type 2 diabetes. So Ms. Gordon, his sister, had breast cancer. And he was reported to his doctor that he was surprised that he had any health-related genetic information, because he remembered that when she had her cancer tumor in her breast, that she had genetic analysis of that tumor, a sample of it, a biopsy, and that that helped to predict the growth, the spread, and the recurrence of her disease. And that there was hope that it would help her physicians guide her chemotherapy or radiation therapy, make a decision of both or one or the other, or any future hormone therapy. Because this kind of tumor analysis, genetic analysis of the tumor tissue, when combined with age of the patient, the stage of the cancer, whether it's spread or not, how large the tumor is, the grade of the cancer tumor, meaning how abnormal are the cells? Are they slightly abnormal or vastly different from normal tissue cells? And then whether the tumor would be susceptible to hormone therapy, because there are receptors in the tumor that would receive the hormone and have it shrink and die off. So there was that kind of tumor tissue genetic testing being done. But there was also for her genetic testing to determine whether her cancer was familial and what level of risk her family members would have. So that meant that when she was discovered to have some variations in her BRCA1 or 2 cancers, cells, oops, oh, there we are. There we are. Yes. In the BRCA1 or 2 cells, number one's on chromosome 17, number two is on chromosome 13, and they're tumor suppressor cells that when they go awry, when they have variations, some of which are benign, don't have any effect, but some of the variations do turn off the suppression of tumors growth. That can cause cancer. But as it was explained to her, only about 5 or 10% of breast cancers are even associated with these two genes. Moreover, there are hundreds of mutations or variations, as we call them, that are identified, and only a few of them are harmful. But with those harmful variations in the genes, a woman would have, an 80% lifetime risk of breast cancer. So that was a reason for offering her family members BRCA1 and 2 genetic testing. Now, it's also the case that this BRCA breast cancer syndrome is related to ovarian cancer as well. And so for women, that could mean an increased risk of a 25% lifetime risk or a 55% lifetime risk. And you can imagine that although women can do mammography and can do individual breast exams to try to feel tumors, very often an ovarian tumor is not discovered until it's really late and thus hard or impossible to treat and cure. It's also important to remember that men can develop breast cancer. And with the BRCA mutations, 1 to 2% of men will in their lifetime develop breast cancer, and 6% of those with the number two gene mutations would develop breast cancer. And that's really important because men don't think about breast cancer. Yet, if they were, for example, Ms. Gordon's brothers, this could be a risk for them and then for their sons and daughters as well. But one of the problems with counseling Ms. Gordon is that, like her brother, she's African American. And as we remember, 96% or so of our studies relevant to genetics of all types is done in those with European descent. And although the Gordons do have some European background, they also have African continental ancestry. And thus it's harder to interpret the meaning of those genetic variants for Ms. Gordon and her family. Because the meaning of variations in genes is not as frequently and reliably established in non-white people, non-European descent people in our country, it's hard to figure out what these changes in mutations mean for them. So as we move on and think about genetic testing and cancer, particularly breast cancer, we now see that there's testing of tumors to guide the decision-making about treatment. And I would say that this kind of testing is comparatively benign, kind of what could be wrong with learning more about how to treat, for example, my breast cancer. It's generally beneficial. It's very much like the pharmacogenomics we've talked about, where testing helps to decide, would this antidepressant or that antidepressant be more effective for me? Would this heart disease drug, this statin, be more effective? Or are there any special risks of increased side effects of taking a statin or of taking an antidepressant? Because, for example, perhaps I slowly metabolize drugs, and that means that more of it will build up, and I might become ill from the drugs. I might have side effects. But overall, there aren't too many social problems or psychological problems that come from this kind of testing for genes, because after all, it's to benefit a patient who already has a condition. On the other hand, the kind of testing that might be done for Ms. Gordon's family members may have more psychosocial, psychological, social, economic risks. And in fact, the benefits, I think, are more contingent. They're more contingent upon other factors, other circumstances. So that when, for example, Angelina Jolie, whom we see here, had breast cancer and then had genetic testing and decided to have prophylactic mastectomy, it made a lot of sense for her, or she made that determination at least, because certainly she had good health insurance. She was already very anxious about breast cancer. And so going ahead and taking charge and doing something for her turned into a very empowering action on her part to go ahead and have prophylactic mastectomy. The fact is that also had the Angelina effect, and a lot of women around that time decided to go in and have BRCA1 and 2 genetic testing to learn their breast cancer risk. But many of them may not have thought about the kinds of implications that that would have for their future decision-making and for their lives. There was a lot of discussion about breast cancer. There was less discussion about ovarian cancer. There was a lot of discussion about prophylactic mastectomy, not so much discussion about removing your ovaries to avoid ovarian cancer and the effects that that would have on hormones, because you all of a sudden, as a potentially young woman, go into menopause. What effects will that have on women's bones later in life if they begin to have menopausal symptoms and loss of hormones much earlier in their lives? What effect would this have on their childbearing? I mean, obviously it has the effect of they would not be able to have children without medical assistance or social assistance of adoption. And that's a huge decision to make as a relatively young woman, and people's views may change over time. So I want to talk a bit about this genetic testing for breast cancer risk. And as I was suggesting, there are obviously potential benefits of prevention, increased surveillance, increased more frequent mammography. There are tests that are done for ovarian cancer that can be done frequently. There are tests, the surveillance recommendations for women who have a positive genetic test result is to have mammography at least twice a year, if not more frequently. And then the prophylactic mastectomy and oophorectomy to remove breast tissue and ovaries. But obviously the interventions impose some burdens. Economics and psychosocial support systems are really relevant to how big those burdens are. Whether one wants to have children or has already completed childbearing is really relevant. And so what is actionable, what a person can act upon clinically, really depends on context. Financial context, social context, where my head is at the time that I get genetic results. So a colleagues and I wrote a paper about the subtle psychological impact of genetic testing. In the very early days, there was concern that people would get bad news and might become incredibly depressed, might commit suicide, might become withdrawn from society, that it might be really severe. And we have found that that's not true. But never, at least, it would be very rare that anyone would have such an extreme response and a persistent response to genetic test results. On the other hand, there can be a fair amount of anxiety. Some of that goes away over time, but it can be pretty intense. And genetic information can change how one views oneself. It can change family dynamics, personal relationships, and it can also lead some people to take action and other people to resign themselves to a kind of fatalism of, well, it's in my genes, I can't do anything about them. So one of the papers written by Rebecca Hamilton was called Being Young, Female, and Breast Cancer Gene Positive, BRCA Positive. And these are some of the things that her interviewees said. One of them, and these were women who were young, and one young as in just turned 18 to maybe 26. They were encouraged by their fathers to have genetic testing, particularly because their mothers had had breast cancer. And really their dads really, really hoped that their test results would show that they were not at the same risk. So the women, many of them, went into the testing a little bit unprepared for the subtle responses that they had. One of them said, I felt like damaged goods. Another said that my ovary surveillance had been set up as a particular test, a CA-125 test every 3 months with ultrasounds and pelvic exams every 6 months. My screening and testing, well, they permeate my life. Emotionally, it sucks. Since my genetic test result, normal life has changed to always having an underlying breast cancer vibe. Now, another woman, and this seems in contrast quite trivial, but it's poignant. She says, you know, people are out shopping and they're trying on things. And my friends are like, oh, that looks so cute on you. Or, oh, I don't have the boobs to fill that out. And then there was this big, huge thing everyone was talking about. Who has boobs and who doesn't and whose are small and whose are big? And I'm thinking, how stupid can these people be? And they are my friends. And of course, that's not what they're thinking about at the time. So she's someone who was facing having a prophylactic mastectomy. Another young woman talked about, there was this guy, and it gave me so much anxiety, just even in the beginning of friendship, because I had no idea where it would go or anything. So it just weighed on me constantly, because my whole thing was like, oh my gosh, these breasts aren't mine. And just having to tell him that, I don't want anyone to think, oh my gosh, she might die soon, so why start a relationship with her? So she's someone who had had a prophylactic mastectomy. And then another woman talked about how she was concerned that my husband's, then my boyfriend's, family and friends would talk him out of being with me because of reasons like polluting his genes or my being too much work. Especially after my husband proposed, I was concerned that his family and friends would think he was marrying me out of pity. And another woman said, I thought my husband's family would think my husband had made a mistake marrying me, that I was a liability to him or them. So as we think about the impact of that very, first of all, well-intentioned preventive intervention of getting genetic testing for risk for breast cancer, it's clear that the timing of that and the context of making the decision to have genetic testing is really important. Person has to consider what effect it may have, not just on breast cancer preventive care, but on other aspects of life, including relatively trivial aspects of, you know, trying on clothes with friends. And when I've taught specifically about those quotations with medical students, some of them will say, well, are you saying that we shouldn't do BRCA testing? I mean, that it's more important to be able to try on clothes than to avoid breast cancer? And of course not. It's very important to try to avoid serious illness. But at the same time, it's important to time the testing. It's important to figure out how to incorporate those test results into one's life and do so in a way that's not disruptive of things that are really important, and figure out ways to just kind of deal with the more trivial aspects, recognizing though that there are going to be strange or unexpected responses to even the trivial aspects of medical information. So as we come back to Mr. Gordon, and his increased risk for type 2 diabetes, well, how should he be feeling about that information? So once again, he's a Black man. So there are the limitations of ancestry. And these polygenic risk scores, they're not diagnostic. They are a form of testing or a development of risk information that's a little bit like the BRCA1 and 2 mutation testing. But instead, it's focused on a wide number of genes across the genome, each of which contribute a little bit, and we don't really understand how they contribute to elevating a person's risk for something like diabetes or heart disease. It doesn't give an absolute risk of you, Mr. Gordon, are going to have an 86% chance of developing diabetes by the age of 75. Instead, it says that he has an increased risk relative to not having those same genes and being in a similar situation in terms of his age and his and ethnicity, ancestry, I should say. Still, this is a matter of association, not causation. We don't really understand how those genes in combination with environment cause or lead to or responsible for disease. And we currently have a real lack of standardization in the calculation of our risk scores. Different laboratories, different groups calculate the level of risk differently, and they're reported in different ways. So there's a lack of standardization, and in fact, clinicians don't have a good understanding of what the particular scores mean. Frankly, currently, they're of questionable validity, and there's been a notorious lack of reproducibility of the same effects in different groups with different investigators examining them. So the clinical utility, the ability to make use of this in the clinic or in daily life, has not really been fully demonstrated. And it is still true that being able to act on the information depends on context or circumstances. So if we think about Mr. Gordon as someone who's depressed, and then he learns he might be at increased risk for diabetes, well, that could for him be just the thing that pops him out of his depression and leads him to take charge of his life and change his diet and become more active in his lifestyle. Or he might just say, hey, I've got, you know, my sister died. I'm depressed. I don't need this. This is just too much. What am I going to do with this information? So it really depends on very individual circumstances. So it's kind of puzzling or funny, ironic, that the genes that we think of as being very individual are in fact just used to place people into different groups. Whereas the, the genes kind of bin us. They put us into different bins or levels of risk groups. And it's really our circumstances that are so individual. Mr. Gordon had a wife that got him to go to the doctor for his depression. She might be someone who could really help him take charge of his diet and lose weight if he needed to and really watch out for diabetes. She might not be. She might really primarily care about the fact that he's not talking to her and really want him to work on his depression and not really support him to try to change a lifestyle around diabetes risk. So that's very individual. So what about type 2 diabetes? Well, we know that being overweight and having an inactive lifestyle are quote unquote responsible for 90 to 95% of cases of diabetes. So that phrase that they are responsible for sounds a lot like causation, but not causation alone. Several genes may be related. We're just not sure exactly what the degree of their effect is. But we do know that there are various risk factors. So triglyceride levels, heart presence of heart disease, blood pressure levels, high fat or carbohydrate diet, high intake of alcohol, being over the age of 45, ethnicity, all of those are risk factors. But again, the magnitude, how much they increase a person's risk, we don't really know. And interestingly, many of these can be known risk factors without doing any genetic testing. Like a person knows whether she's African American or Asian American, Native American, Hispanic, all of which are associated with a higher level of risk than being of European ancestry. Person knows what diet is, knows, can easily have a blood pressure taken. So what I want to begin to wrap up by emphasizing is how genetic information can have impact on beliefs and behaviors. Seemingly has more impact or slightly different kind of impact than blood pressure levels, triglyceride levels, other sorts of medical and social information like about my diet and lifestyle. These are colleagues who did an analysis of newspaper articles addressing the connection between genetics and obesity. from the period of 1990 through the mid 2007. And they reviewed over 775 articles. They found that many. They meticulously reviewed about 110 of them, 109. And they found that over that period from 1990 to 2007, there was a shift away from a deterministic understanding of obesity toward more of a view of personal responsibility. So the articles were all about genetics and obesity. So the role of your genes in your weight. But there was a shift in attitude, in kind of interpretation. In the beginning, there was more of a sense of this is in your genes, it's deterministic, it's first of all not your fault if you're overweight, it's your genes. And secondly, that there may not be that much you can do about it. That's why it's not your fault. But over time, many of the same kinds of findings of a connection between genetics and obesity shifted, and the interpretation was, it's in your genes, so you should know better and do something about this to avoid being overweight. You're at increased genetic risk, so you have a special responsibility to try to avoid becoming overweight. So the similar kinds of information about a connection between genetics and obesity had different effects on beliefs and behaviors, or at least potentially so, from a kind of deterministic can't do anything to it's in your genes, you must do something to try to avoid this kind of fate. And there was also a shift during this time from a kind of forgivingness of individual behavior to more blaming, and different attitudes toward supporting public policy that would encourage better diet, that would provide places for better exercise, more exercise. Attitudes toward things like the sugar tax on drinks, you know, a tax on sugary carbonated drinks or juices, that sort of thing. Those who attributed genetic or environmental factors came to be more likely to support obesity prevention policies, whereas those who attributed obesity to lifestyle choices were less likely to support such policies. So that shift from fatalism to you better do something to avoid your fate has an effect on our public policy as well. Now I'm talking about obesity in the context of Mr. Gordon and his type 2 diabetes, in part because obesity is such a risk factor for diabetes as well. So what I was suggesting is that I find ironic is that genetic variation can be used to sort people into different risk groups, but behavior, including individual behavior and public policy kinds of behavior, are the missing link in terms of making this sorting of people into risk groups actually valuable to us. It's also, I think, surprising to realize that for many people, it's actually easier to have the radical surgery of a prophylactic mastectomy than to undertake a lifetime of avoiding overweight and encouraging an active lifestyle. It's easier to do one very radical invasive thing than to change one's habits kind of forever. So we have to ask whether increasing knowledge of our risks empowers us or disempowers us, leads us to action or leads us to kind of sit back and say, what can I do? Throw up our hands. Genetic information can lead to a genetic understanding of things, of risks, of diagnoses, of problems. And then having this genetic understanding can lead either to action or resignation, empowerment or fatalism. And it also can lead, as we'll talk a bit more next time, can lead us to individualize problems. Because after all, it's in the individual's genes, rather than thinking of something as a social problem about which we could do something for everybody. So even if we undertake a social policy that encourages particular behaviors for those who are at a genetically related increased risk, we're undertaking something that's specific for those at-risk individuals, not for everyone in general. So that we could see an insurer not charging a higher price for insurance. That's prohibited by the GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. But maybe an insurer could say, have genetic testing, find out what your level of risk is for diabetes. And if you're at an increased risk and you get a gym membership, we'll pay for that. Or if you're at increased risk for diabetes or for heart disease and you improve your diet, we'll give you a $30 credit every month on your insurance premium. And those actions have not been prohibited. And my concern is that they are still very individual and they rest on the individual's level of risk, when in fact, except in COVID times, everybody could probably benefit from having and using a gym membership or from improved diet. So that socializing of a problem, of looking at social solutions for people in general, has ripple effect benefits, whereas individualizing problems could have more negative effects. So next time we'll talk about this a little bit, and we'll talk about it in relation to our American, some would say our rather Protestant heritage, a belief in merit, and merit as being very important to pretty much everything that we value in our society. And then think about what genetic enhancement could do to that. Does it undercut the belief in merit? If, for example, we can just enhance our babies so that they have a leg up in school or in athletic competition and so on. So I want to look at genetics or genomics as a tool, but in this case, as a tool, potential tool for enhancement, and what that might mean for the nature-nurture relationship and for what is considered natural and kind of untouchable, we can't change it, and what we consider social and under our power. So that's for next time. And for this time, have I stirred up any thoughts that you'd like to share?
Mr. Oh my, haven't you? So I'll just start with a question for you and encourage people to jump right in. I think, you know, this points to a whole lot of things that are really, really fundamental, both, you know, in science and also in faith. And one of the things that comes to mind in what you're saying about how people respond to information about genetic markers of health really, in a way, is perhaps not so different from how people respond to information about health in general. It's just like the genetic information has this aura around it of being mysterious and super scientific and beyond question. But a lot of it comes back to the difficulty that we have accepting the unavoidable fact of our own mortality and frailty, which is kind of why we show up at church, because a lot of us figure out that, oh my gosh, I'm going to die no matter what I do. So I wonder if you could just reflect on that a little bit for us.
I'll try. And I'm certainly not either a theologian or somewhat, I mean, I come to this through I'm neither the theologian nor the scientist, right? I come to this as a person who's just been thinking about these issues a lot, and professionally with some philosophical background. So that was my stall. I do think that all of us wrestle at some point with this question of, you know, so I'm going to die, why should I bother, right? Or this relationship's going to come to an end. My dogs occasionally come walking in and out of the room while we're talking. And someone once said to me that one of the most hopeful things a person can do is to have a pet, particularly a dog that usually, you know, lives with us for, you know, lasts in memory forever and lives with us for, if we're lucky, 15 years. So why do we put ourselves through this horrible sadness, knowing that it's going to come to an end? But we do, we make an investment. We do it part, you know, in the case of a dog, largely, you know, selfishly, right? Because we love them and enjoy the companionship and so on. And maybe also because we take some poor stray off the street and give them a good home. But that's really what we do with regard to pretty much all of our information, whether it's about climate change, about our health, about the health of those we love, and investing in a relationship and trying to help those folks be healthier. It's partly because, yep, as long as we're going to be around, we want to have those circumstances surrounding us as good as they can be, both for us and for those other people. But it's true, there is always that alternative of just kind of the negative of why. So I got into philosophy through existentialism, which pretty much was asking those waiting for Godot kinds of questions of kind of why bother. Yeah, well, because that's all we can do. And I do think, though, that there's a difference of whether we individually and as families and so on embrace the information, or whether it's kind of sneaked in on us or foisted upon us, like being required to get genetic testing or other health testing that imposes the information. Or having it just kind of occur, like for Mr. Gordon, where he got a lot of health information when he was really looking for something else. But when we embrace the information because we want to try to do something with it, that seems like an act of hope and commitment to ourselves and the world and to other people.
And I'll just bookend that by saying some people respond to the inevitability of death with a kind of a desperate desire to deny it. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the other end of the spectrum, from why bother to, oh, I can, my life depends on this. I must do this and this and this so that I won't die. Well, guess what? You are going to die. So you need to land somewhere in the middle.
That's right. Mr. Fraser, did you?
No, I didn't.
Okay. I saw your microphone light blink.
John?
Okay, I have a philosophical question.
Okay.
being a bit of a philosopher myself, but I know I'm going to die. I also know that maybe part of when I die is up to me, in the sense that I can take care of my health. So looking at things from a genetic standpoint, if I have a risk of breast cancer, it would help me to know what the percentage of that risk is and what the other factors may be. Like maybe it's multifactorial. Mm-hmm. And you have a 2% chance of having breast cancer. Then I'd want to think about all the other factors, like things I can do, or, and I'm sure we don't know all the factors, but at least I might have some control over whether or not the other 98% of the factors might be at work. So if I go to a genetic store to get an analysis and they say you have a risk of breast cancer, I'm going to want to know what are the other factors, and let's be multifactorial about this. If I'm 2% likely to get it from a genetic standpoint, tell me about these other factors that I might have in mind that I might have some control over.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And there kind of are two ways of thinking about it, because on the one hand, most of those things that you could have some control over beyond the genetic factors are things you could do anyway. You could eat well, exercise, get enough sleep, have relationships with humans and non-humans that are rewarding to you and comforting. All of those good things, some of which are pretty hard to do, particularly during a pandemic, or if you lack financial resources, and if you have debilitating pain, so they're not easy, but they are things that a person could do without knowing whether she's at higher or lower risk for breast cancer, higher or lower risk for colon cancer. Now, it is true that if, particularly if a person is in a family where there is a familial risk of colon cancer, those colonoscopies should begin at an earlier age. So in that regard, knowing what the genetic risk is can lead a person and justify a person undertaking medical interventions earlier, like the surveillance of more mammograms or colonoscopy. And it's valuable to know that. Particularly, I mean, mammogram, yeah, there's a little radiation, but there isn't that much of a downside. But there's a risk to colonoscopy because, it's very, very rare, but a person can have her colon perforated during that procedure, and that can lead to, serious illness. So you don't want to do it willy-nilly. You want to have a good reason, either because you're at a particular age where everyone's risk for colon cancer goes up, so you begin your colonoscopies, or because you're in a family where it makes sense to begin that back at age, 30 or so. So the genetic information, I think you're exactly right, John, it can trigger some behaviors. Some of them are medical. It can also prompt some people to really be encouraged to live well, have good relationships, have good diet, have good exercise and good sleep. Unless you have a reason to think, though, that you might be in a higher risk family and want to know, do I have my family gene for colon cancer or not? It's not clear yet that it's always valuable to have the genetic testing to find out, because in the absence of a family history, we sometimes don't know what those genetic mutations mean. They could mean nothing. A lot of genetic variation means nothing in terms of our health. So when it's multifactorial, which the accurate term to use, it's a matter of family history and personal medical history and lifestyle and diet and genetics. You're exactly right, that finding out that information can lead to some good increased behaviors. But there's a lot we can do without ever knowing the genetics.
I have a am I unmuted?
You are. You can talk, Bobby.
This is a weird question. I'm really a science person, and this is a non-science question. But, there have been novels written about people who had the opportunity to know the future. Mm-hmm. And doesn't this have a little bit of that? And isn't there a sense in which we ought not to? In the stories that I've read, things usually turn out badly. That as it might even be unconscious on the part of people who are thinking, no, I don't want to do that because I don't have any business knowing that. Mm-hmm. I just wonder your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I do think that most of those stories are written to kind of warn people off wanting to know things they ought not know, about the future. I think the ones that I have found most intriguing and sort of most hopeful and not quite as scary or negative, dystopian, are those where someone uses that foreknowledge in a very limited way to do good for someone else, which is sort of what we're always trying to do. Not predicting the future of our children per se, you know, but knowing that getting an education is a good thing. Maybe developing a talent, forcing somebody to take some piano lessons so they have some understanding of music, on the assumption and the hope that being exposed to music early might lead to a lifelong love of melody and humming and singing and the fellowship of a choir or whatever. That's why parents, you know, do something for someone else, partly predicting the future, what they think will be good. But to be too specific about it, or to try to do it for, you know, globally outside of kind of your own purview of your own family, you know, does in fiction and probably in real life get people in trouble. So yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that we are appropriately reluctant to try to know the future, predict the future, and especially to control the future. Everything we do, I think, is partly setting us up for the next bit of future, right? You go grocery shopping, you plan to make the food the next couple of days. It's a little bit hopeful. You think you'll be here the next couple of days so that the, you know, bananas won't just be on the countertop rotting. So we make these plans, but we do it in a limited way for people and for periods of time, and keeping our options open so that if the people that I'm cooking for hate bananas, I also have something else on my shelf, something else to serve for dessert besides the banana cake. If my kids really wind up hating piano and hating music and having a tin ear, well, I say, the time you spent, it was good. You learned a little bit of discipline. That's a good thing. Thank you very much. But I didn't make you so narrowly focused on music that that's all you know. And you can't move on to really investigate, you know, science and nature or build things with your, you know, with your hands and your brains. So we keep our options open too.
Bob Dilley had his microphone off, so I'm going to call on him and see if he had something that he wanted to say. And then I also see Joan has her microphone turned on. So Bob and then Joan.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, I noticed in your slides, several of them, you had pie charts that dealt with the underrepresentation of race and ethnicity. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to reconcile my understanding that race and ethnicity are not genetic based, and yet that seems to be a factor in evaluating genetic results. Yeah. How does one reconcile those two ideas?
It's a real mess. Partly it's a mess because of the language and that it's so wordy to talk about people from different continental ancestries. So we often will revert to saying race or ethnicity when what we really mean is people of continental ancestry, because as people moved from one continent to another, they related, married, bred, mated, and genes began to, genetic variation was introduced. So with that mixing, you can note changes in ancestry of then the mixing of two continents and moving on. So we can trace back where a person's ancestors came from, or at least we claim that we can. And I think over time, we will get better at being able to figure this out because we'll have more people from more different continents feeding in their genes into our algorithms for figuring out, you know, which genetic variation is related to which continental ancestry. Race, as we use it in census forms and racist practices, different things, is a social construct. And it's very often built on, you know, skin color and appearance. Ethnicity, gosh, ethnicity is a little bit maybe that social construct, but it's also the what country and culture and language one is from. It would be more precise to talk about linguistic communities and cultural practices, you know, national identities, if one still, you know, really identifies with one's Irish heritage, that kind of thing, even though one lives in, you know, Southern Florida. So it's a mess. It's a complete mess. But there does seem to be some difference in the genetics of people from different continents so that it matters in interpreting genes, whether the background, the other genes in the genome, are those more frequent in African continental ancestry or Asian continental ancestry or European continental ancestry and so forth. A scientist, Bobby signed off, would perhaps be able to explain it better. The National Institutes of Health, one final point, requires us to use, scientists to use racial categories, you know, African, I actually think it's Black, white, Asian, something, something. And it's partly because they want to be sure that we're not neglecting people of different socially constructed groups the way we did for a long time of basically doing our research on white men. So that's why they have those categories. But then the scientists themselves want to use continental ancestry categories for their genetic studies. And they try to do that. But until we have enough information, it's hard to figure out precisely that someone is from this continental ancestry plus that one and not that one, because we may not have enough genetics in our pool of different varieties of genes to create our reference so that we can then compare Joe here to that reference genome to figure it out. Sorry.
Joan?
Yes, I just wanted to comment on the behavioral aspect of sharing healthcare information. And this comes from someone who is never able to rest in the notion that I have enough information. Mm-hmm. But I think we have to be cognizant of how people respond to information and in general, not just healthcare, but you know, where you fit on the locus of control scale.
Yes.
You know, do I believe that life happens to me? Or do I believe on the other extreme that I have some ability to control what happens to me? And, you know, there are so many things when we're teaching people about their risk or that we have to consider. I think it's important to take that into consideration, because there are people that we are going to be giving too much information. It's overwhelming. They don't know what to do with it. And so they react in ways that we don't anticipate.
I think that's exactly right. And so, yeah, taking into account those behavioral factors, that locus of control, you know, scale or idea, I think is really important. It's also important to realize that some people who are, you know, very, very controlling about almost most aspects of their lives may be willing to let some aspect just go to chance because they're focused here, not there. Mm-hmm. So it remains very individual, like it's a dyad of an individual and the information. May respond differently to different kinds of information. It's really hard to figure out. And it's hard for people in genetics, really in any health related field, because you can't ask someone, do you want to know? Like, if I know some information about your health risk, would you want to know it? most everybody's going to say yes, partly because we're schooled to want information. We think it looks bad if we say, nope, don't want to know it. Or we might have a good excuse. No, I don't want to know that now. My daughter's getting married next weekend. Tell me later. That's socially acceptable. But to just say, nope, I don't want to know about my genetic risk for my health, it just doesn't sound good in our society. And so, therefore, it's really hard for health professionals and scientists to know how to ask people and find out what information they would like to have and what information they prefer not to know.
So I have about 100 more questions, but we're already 5 minutes over. So I'm going to stop the recording and let people hang on to the extent that they want and ask their questions, okay?